From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some thoughts on race in America from a man who's lived as a white and as an African American. Gregory Howard Williams lived on the white side of the color line in Virginia until he was 10. Then he found out his father was a light-skinned black who was passing for white. That year, Williams' parents separated, and he was sent to live with black relatives on his father's side of the family. Also today, bugs in the system. We talk with entomologist May Berenbaum about the insect world and about her annual Insect Fear Film Festival. And Gerald Early reviews the collected poems of Langston Hughes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has attacked Republican proposals that impose a moratorium on new government regulations. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
Mr. Clinton laid it out in simple terms. He favors reform of the government regulatory system, but not the way the congressional Republicans want to do it, including a moratorium on any new regulations. Mr. Clinton calls the Republican proposals extreme and says they would cost lives and dollars.
A small army of special interest lobbyists knows they can never get away with an outright repeal of consumer or environmental protection. But why bother if you can paralyze the government by process?
Mr. Clinton has a regulatory reform initiative of his own in which he's ordering, among other things, a page-by-page review of federal regulations to be completed by June 1st. Bill Small at the White House.
A group of travel agents is getting ready to battle airlines. The American Society of Travel Agents is going to court to try to get the airlines to lift a cap on ticket commissions. Most domestic airlines announced the cap this month to cut costs. Commissions cost airlines more than $6 billion last year. Now carriers will pay agents a maximum of $50 for round-trip tickets instead of a 10% commission per tickets. Small agents fear they could be driven out of business. A German newspaper reports Israel and Iran are conducting secret negotiations to arrange the release of an Israeli pilot. Ron Arad has been held captive by pro-Iranian groups since his capture in Lebanon in October 1986. NPR's Dietra Berger reports.
The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung says the negotiations have taken place the last few years in the German chancellor's office. Israeli and Iranian officials allegedly have been meeting in separate rooms, with mediation by German officials. This has included handing over a video of Iran to the Israelis and a letter written by him to his wife. The newspaper quotes unnamed security officials who say a breakthrough in the talks is imminent. The Iranian embassy in Bonn denies the report. Iran is thought to be in the hands of the Hezbollah or the Revolutionary Guards in Lebanon. Both groups are pro-Iranian. Iran reportedly wants Israel to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and to hand over a Shiite intelligence chief and a Hezbollah leader. The Israelis want Iran to stop supporting the radical Hamas movement, which is conducting a terrorist campaign against Israel. I'm Dietra Berger reporting.
Italian security is tight as officials begin the trial of reputed mafia boss of bosses. Salvatore Toto Riina is among 37 defendants accused of the 1992 killing of the country's top prosecutor who fought organized crime. The slain prosecutor, Giovanni Falcone, was regarded as a symbol of Italy's renewed efforts to crack down on organized crime. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow rose 10.5 points to end at 3,963. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR. The state of Florida is launching a $1.4 billion lawsuit against tobacco firms for the costs of welfare patients who got sick smoking. Florida Governor Lawton Chiles says the tobacco industry should pay for the, quote, carnage tobacco causes. But the nation's two largest tobacco firms, Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds, have asked the Florida Supreme Court to block the lawsuit. Philip Morris and other businesses have already sued to overturn the Florida law that makes it easier to sue tobacco companies. An outbreak of meningitis has killed two adults in Washington state. The highly contagious disease has also spread to six children at an elementary school in Seattle. From member station KPLU, Carolyn Leary reports.
Five of the students are listed in satisfactory condition at a Seattle hospital. The sixth is being tested for the disease. Meningitis is transmitted person to person like a common cold through coughing and sneezing. It starts with a high fever and a headache and other flu symptoms. Officials say there's no vaccine for the strand of bacteria involved in the outbreak, but health officials say antibiotics are an effective treatment. School officials where the outbreak has occurred are providing medicine to all 900 students. No other schools in the area are reporting any cases. Medical investigators suspect some of the students became infected at a Valentine's Day dance. They are still looking for a connection between these cases and the two adults who died from the disease earlier this month. For National Public Radio, I'm Caroline Leary in Seattle.
The federal government says it's collected a record $703 million in back child support. The government says it kept the tax refunds of deadbeat parents who owed money. State child support enforcement agencies report the names of parents who owe child support to federal authorities. The parents who owe are told their refunds will be withheld, but they can contest it. Collections on the 94 tax year begin as tax returns are filed this year. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gregory Howard Williams, has a unique perspective on race in America. He spent part of his life as a white person, part of it as an African American. Until he was 10, he lived a middle-class life in Virginia with his parents, who he believed were white. Then his mother walked out on the family business fell apart, and his father told him the truth. Gregory's father was really a light-skinned black who was passing for white. After the divorce, when Gregory's father was in debt and drinking too much, he took Gregory and his brother Mike to live with poor black relatives in the slums of Muncie, Indiana. From that time on, Gregory lived as an African American. Gregory Williams is now the dean of the Ohio State University College of Law. He's written a new memoir called Life on the Color Line. I asked him to read the passage after he learns that his father is black.
I didn't understand, Dad. I knew I wasn't colored, and neither was he. My skin was white. All of us are white, I said to myself. But for the first time, I had to admit Dad didn't exactly look white. His deeply tanned skin puzzled me as I sat there trying to classify my own father. Goosebumps covered my arms as I realized that whatever he was, I was. I took a deep breath. I couldn't make any mistakes. I looked closer. His heavy lips and dark brown eyes didn't make him colored, I concluded. His black wavy hair was different from Negro's hair, but it was different from most white folks' hair, too. He was darker than most whites, but Mom said he was Italian. That was why my baby brother had such dark skin and curly hair. Mom told us to be proud of our Italian heritage. That's it, I decided. He was Italian. I leaned back against the seat, satisfied. Yet the unsettling image of Miss Sally flashed before me like a neon sign. Colored, colored, colored. He continued, "Life is going to be different from now on. In Virginia, you are white boys. In Indiana, you're going to be colored boys. I want you to remember that you're the same today that you were yesterday. But people in Indiana will treat you differently."
When your father told you that life is going to be different now and people would treat you differently, what was your impression of what it meant to be black? What had you seen that made the biggest impression on you?
Up until age 10, we had lived and kind of a privileged existence in Virginia. My father had a restaurant and beer tavern, was masquerading as a white man there. I went to whites-only swimming pools, whites-only skating rinks, whites-only schools. And I saw that I really had a very different life than my black playmates who lived near us near the restaurant, because I had visited some of their schools, and those schools were not the same quality in terms of physical facilities that I had attended in Virginia. And so when we went back to Indiana, I knew, based on that Virginia experience, that there were going to be a lot of doors that were going to be closed to me if I was black.
Did you want to protest and say, "Look at me, no, I'm not black, somebody's made a terrible mistake"?
Absolutely. I looked at that and I said, this can't be true. It's absolutely impossible. I'd never heard anything crazier in my life. And I resisted it and didn't believe it and didn't believe that my dad was telling me the truth and was angry about it. But the more he talked about it, the more I realized that he was telling the truth and that our lives were going to be different if Virginia or if Indiana was anything like Virginia.
When you got to Indiana, your father took you to live with your Aunt Bessie. And then when she didn't want to take care of you, you were given to your grandmother. Your grandmother had actually worked at your parents' tavern. I guess your father was afraid that if he admitted she was his mother and didn't just call her an employee, he wouldn't be able to pass.
Right.
I mean, you didn't even know she was your grandmother. You thought she was just the help when she worked there.
Right. When she had kind of mysteriously drifted in and out of our lives a number of times, and she was always introduced to me as Miss Sally, the maid or the cook or whatever, and that's what I thought she was because that's the way she had been identified to me. But my father really had to ignore her and not recognize her as his mother if he was going to be able to continue his charade of passing in Virginia. And that was something that was kept from my brother and the rest of us.
So when you actually went to live with her, was she pretty resentful of how the family had treated her?
Oh, she was very resentful. She was resentful of the fact that my father had ignored her and that her own little grandchildren had ignored her and, you know, were calling her Miss Sally instead of grandmother. And she was very, very bitter about the treatment that she had received, and rightfully so, because she had not been acknowledged as being related to my family at all. And when we were back in Muncie, to some extent, I think she relished the fact that my father had failed in his efforts to pass as white and be as successful as he had wanted to be.
Why did your father want to pass?
I think it was largely an economic decision, as it is for many people who pass for white. In Virginia, I remember in the early 50s, my father was enormously successful, and I remember seeing a tax return where he had a gross income of over $50,000. When we returned to Muncie, Indiana, he never had a job in which he made more than $50 a week. And so it was economic. There was an economic incentive to be white. However, he didn't realize that there was more to life than economics and that there was a pretty heavy price he had to pay for trying to be white, even though he did receive tremendous economic success or achieve tremendous economic success.
So when your mother left the family, your father gave up passing for white?
Well, he tried to continue the business for a while, but his drinking got worse and worse, and the business pretty much ended. He was able to get a job at the Pentagon as security guard for a while, but the drinking got worse and worse. He couldn't handle the business by himself, and he pretty much was a defeated man after my mother left. And so we just struggled on in Virginia for about, another 6-7 months before everything just totally disintegrated.
So when your father first took you to live with relatives, what were some of the immediate ways in which your life changed, your neighborhood, the house, the way people saw you?
Well, we had visited my white grandparents who lived in Muncie over the summers and holidays for a number of years. And every time we would go to Muncie to visit them, we would go into a nice suburban community. When we got off the bus after the family had disintegrated and left the bus station, we walked down South Walnut Street and then down the railroad. And that was a view of Muncie that I'd never, ever seen before. We found ourselves in the middle of the black housing projects and in the black area of Muncie where buildings were falling down and that everything was in disrepair. And I, for the first time, saw a view of Muncie that was absolutely foreign to me. And that was my first indication that life was, in fact, going to be very different. Then actually we started to elementary school, and I didn't think I was going to be treated differently in school, but I quickly found out that I was going to be treated differently.
How were you treated differently?
Well, once my heritage was discovered, I did make some initial friends with some of the white students, and I remember one particular case, there were two girls, white girls, who I became very friendly with that first week of school, and was trying to kind of reach out and make friends and that type of thing, and we had a really great conversation. They knew that I was from Washington, D.C., and I'd been to the Washington Monument and been to Mount Vernon and places like that, and was able to explain all that to them. But then one afternoon, apparently they discovered that I was black. And from that time on, they never, ever spoke to me again. And that was my first real indication that I was, in fact, going to be treated differently.
What about black children in school? Did they accept you as black even though you looked white?
Well, my brother and I found ourselves up on the Black Housing Project's playground in Muncie, and of course everybody around there wondered, who are these two little white boys? And my brother and I had a lot of fights because people wonder who we were, what the hell we were doing there, and that it wasn't until we met our other black cousins and then that support group that we finally began to be accepted on the playgrounds and in the community. But it was a while before we were accepted.
What was most foreign to you about the culture that you are now a part of?
Well, the poverty, actually. We had a very, very upper middle class existence in Virginia, and in Indiana we had absolutely nothing. My grandmother worked as a cook for about 50 cents an hour, and the only way that we were able to eat was what she was able to, I guess, steal from the restaurant. She would usually slip a hamburger patty or a few French fries in her pocketbook that she would take out of the restaurant at night. And so we went from having everything to having absolutely nothing and just pretty much living at a starvation level.
After staying with your grandmother a while, you were taken in by a woman named Miss Dora, who virtually became your mother. Tell us something about her, who she was, and why she took you in.
Well, she had been a friend of the family for a long time. In, I guess, the 30s, her husband was a gambler and a bootlegger and had a reputation of, I guess, kind of in that world in Muncie. But he had died, and she had become a very religious woman. But she still had very close ties to my family, was friendly to my father and my grandmother. And she would come by the house where we lived at, well, if you can call it a house, actually it was a shack. The address was 601 and a half Railroad Street, and we were right on the railroad. And I remember later years she told me, she said, you know, Greg, she said, I walked in that alley one night, and that's the only way you could get to our house was to walk through the alley. And I saw Sally, your grandmother, my grandmother, and your dad, Buster, they were both laying out there on this dirt yard, passed out drunk. And you boys were just sitting there on a plank bench waiting for him to wake up. And she said, my heart just went out to you. She said, I cannot let that continue. And so she was a domestic, and she made $25 a week. And she realized that that really wasn't enough money to support both of us. And so what she was doing in terms of inviting us up to her house to stay overnight was to decide which one of us she would take. And that I remember the night that I went up to kind of stay overnight with her, I was kind of fidgeting around in bed, apparently, and then kind of had a bad dream and woke up, and she came and calmed me and put me back to sleep or back in the bed. And then I saw her walk into her room and saw her kneel down beside her bed and start praying. And she told me that what she was doing was trying to pray to get some guidance to decide which one of us to take. But that night, she decided that she could not choose between us, that she had to take us both, no matter the fact that she only made $25 a week and just didn't have anything else, any other possibilities to support us. But our need was so great, and her concern about our safety was so high that she just couldn't let us continue to live in the situation with our father and grandmother.
That's a really remarkable story.
It's incredible. She saved our lives. I would not have survived Muncie without her. And this is a woman with an eighth grade education who had absolutely nothing, but she was 52 years old when she took us in. And I think back, what is it like for a widow woman who has no money, no resources whatsoever, but is willing to take two little boys, 10 years and 8 years old, you know, just to take them in. I mean, it's just absolutely mind-boggling, the sacrifice that she made for us and willing to share everything she had with us.
My guest is Gregory Howard Williams, author of the new memoir, Life on the Color Line. He's now the dean of the Ohio State University College of Law. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with Gregory Howard Williams, author of the memoir Life on the Color Line, the story of a white boy who discovered he was black.
When you were coming of age, did you think of yourself as being white or being black or being biracial?
When we went back to Muncie, we were totally ostracized from the white community. I had a grandmother, a grandfather. I had a lot of aunts and uncles, and I had a lot of cousins. They pretty much ostracized us. I would see them every once in a while, but I was in classes with white cousins who would refuse to speak to me. They didn't want the other classmates to know that they were related to me. I was in the same class with black cousins, and I was embraced, and I was accepted by them. I was part of the black community. So there was never any question as to, that I was going to be white. We were always ostracized by the white community. So my self-identification was black by virtue of that experience, and that was the way it always was. That's the way everyone else identified me, and that's the way I ultimately identified myself, and I was the person that, that Muncie wanted me to be.
10 years after your mother walked out on the family, she came back in, and she said that you know, this was a good thing that her husband, her second husband, offered to give you boys his name and adopt you. What did you make of this?
Well, I made of that this was a woman who had no foot in reality. She didn't want to talk about what had happened to us. She didn't want to know anything about how we'd lived or who we'd lived with or what we had to do to survive. When I saw her that night, it was like, well, did you get the milk while you're out? You know, I just had just stepped out to buy some milk and some bread. And there was never any discussion of what happened in all those years. Why didn't she come and see us? Why, you know, why had we been abandoned? And that we were just supposed to walk back into her lives and do what she wanted to do, and that we were supposed to jump up and down and be grateful that she was willing to walk back into our lives and be, you know, pull us in and allow us to be adopted by her second husband, who was a very nice man. I have, you know, nothing against him. He's very nice and a very kind person.
And he was white, and your mother is white, too. So they were also offering you the opportunity to be white again.
Right. And I paid too many dues then, and there's too many people that had stood beside me at times that no one would wanted to stand beside me. And even thinking about that meant that I had to abandon them and all that they meant to me, and that was a step that I was not prepared to make and would not make under any circumstances.
When you went to college and then law school, did race mean something different than it did in public school when you were there? Were there less stereotypes to contend with? Were people more just
Well, I think there were still a lot of stereotypes, but many of the professors that I met were a lot different than the teachers that I had met and had been my teachers in the schools in Muncie. There were more teachers who were much more interested in my own abilities and what I could do and what I could achieve as opposed to my racial background. I went back to Muncie recently and I saw one of my coaches. This was a coach who selected me as the quarterback on the football team when I was in the seventh grade, and he told me, said, "Greg, you have tremendous athletic ability, and if you continue to progress, you're going to, you know, be a football player at Muncie Central High School." And in fact, I did turn out. I was a starting quarterback on the Muncie Central football team. So he was right in that regard. But when I went back a few years ago, he said, "Greg," he said, after, you know, I have 5 degrees and, you know, a law professor and other things, he said, "Greg, I never knew you were that smart. What did you do in Muncie? Did you hide your abilities under a bushel basket?" And I just kind of laughed to myself, because what was happening there, that was his perception, was colored by race. When he looked at me, even though I didn't look black, he saw this black kid and assumed that I had athletic talent, but I had no intellectual abilities. By the time I got to college, there were more teachers who were willing to look at my intellectual abilities and to be less clouded by their views about what I could or could not achieve based on my racial background.
You seem to know from a pretty young age that you wanted to be a lawyer. How did you know that?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know I've tried to sort that out, and I don't know whether that was really my father's dream or my dream. I think initially it was my father's dream. He had wanted to be a lawyer, and for whatever reason was not able to pursue that. And so he continued to and reinforce that desire in me. But ultimately I did embrace that dream, because it seemed to me that by being a professional, by being a lawyer, I was going to be in a position to make some difference in the community, to be in a situation where I might have people listening to what I have to say and be able to have some influence in public policy decisions, although I didn't obviously articulate it in that way when I was a kid, but I felt that it gave me a certain power and influence and ability to kind of stand up and say things in my community and people would listen to me. And so that was a real goal and objective of mine from the day we walked back to Muncie, that somehow or another I wanted to change the circumstances of my life. And instead of being a person in a world over which I had absolutely no control, to at least to be able to try to control my destiny and to have some influence on what people were deciding about me and other people like me.
You're married to a woman who is white. How do your children identify racially?
Well, my children were not ostracized from the white side of their family in the way that I was. And so they know that the white side of their family, as well as the black side of their family, love them, care about them, and support them. And they're proud of their black heritage as well as their white heritage. And they feel that they have both. And that's an important thing for them. And I think that's very positive.
You know, you're the dean now of the Ohio State University College of Law. Your younger brother, who got into trouble a lot as a kid, ended up being blinded in a shooting in a bar. What's his life like now?
Well, he was shot in a bar about 20 years ago, and he's blind as a result of that shooting, and he's had a very tough life, and things have not worked out well for him. He has, however, made some remarkable strides. He is taking college. He finished high school, got his GED, and has been taking college classes. And he is he's working very hard, but unfortunately, his life has not worked out for him as well as I had hoped, or as well as he had wanted. But he has put together a life, and he has a lot of friends and companions in Indiana, and he has found an existence for him that is working.
Do you think that what we think of as race is really more a function of culture than anything else?
I think it is to a large extent, and that's what a lot of people say to me. They say, well, you don't look black. How can you be black? And I think my response to that is the issue in America has never been skin color. The issue has always been race, and the issue has been to divide society along racial lines. And if it is discovered that you have any black heritage, then in the American way to try to classify people on one side or the other, we've always tried to push on one side or the other. And as a consequence, we've not really been able to look at people as individuals and to evaluate them on their abilities and to help and assist everyone achieve all the things that they can achieve.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Gregory Howard Williams is the author of the new memoir, Life on the Color Line. Williams is the dean of the Ohio State University College of Law. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Times Books, publisher of Lynn Schur's new book, Failure is Impossible, Susan B. Anthony in Her Own Words. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, why insects are able to crawl across the ceiling without falling off. We talk with entomologist Mae Barenbaum about that and other fascinating facts concerning the six-legged creatures that are often our uninvited guests. Barenbaum is the author of the new book, Bugs in the System. She also hosts the annual Insect Fear Film Festival at the University of Illinois, which is coming up this weekend. And Gerald Early reviews the collected poems of Langston Hughes, edited by Arnold Rampersand. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. and Mexican negotiators have worked out a $20 billion plan to support the Mexican economy. The agreement was signed today in a ceremony at the Treasury Department. NPR's John Itzty reports.
After 6 days of intense negotiations in Washington, the two sides have agreed to terms for the rescue plan announced by President Clinton on January 30th. The United States will provide $20 billion in loans and loan guarantees for the Mexican government. Commitments from other sources bring the total package to $52 billion. The Clinton administration negotiators insisted that Mexico meet strict conditions, among them that all revenue from Mexican oil exports be funneled through the New York Federal Reserve Bank, so that if Mexico defaults on its U.S. loans, the oil revenue can be used to pay off the loans. Also, yesterday, Mexico raised short-term interest rates 10% to nearly 50% to keep inflation under control, something U.S. negotiators were anxious to see. While that may help attract much-needed foreign capital, it will also cause a sharp slowdown in the Mexican economy. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
The nation's largest Protestant church says it will oppose President Clinton's nominee for Surgeon General. Leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention have planned a news conference tomorrow to announce their opposition to Dr. Henry Foster. They plan to reject him for his, quote, advocacy of abortion. Foster has come under fire for performing abortions in his practice as an obstetrician-gynecologist. He says he believes that abortion should be, quote, safe, legal, and rare. The Southern Baptists have 15 million members. They're based in Nashville, Foster's home. Acting Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig and Players Union Chief Donald Fear are meeting in Milwaukee today. They'll try again to end the six-month-old baseball strike. Marge Pitroff of member station WUWM reports.
Today marks one of the few times Interim Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig will take part in negotiations with the union. Today is also the day Selig's Milwaukee Brewers open spring training camp. Most teams are using replacement players, and some wonder whether that situation is adding urgency to attempts to end the longest strike in sports history. Federal mediator W.J. Ussery talked with both Selig and Fear last weekend about his plans to resume negotiations. Among other changes, Ussery will have fewer representatives from each side taking part in the talks and hopes to conduct them in a more low-profile setting than in the past. Ussery believes the circus-like atmosphere which has surrounded all previous bargaining sessions has imposed too many distractions on those involved. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Pitroff in Milwaukee.
Georgia officials say the Oconee River is still rising, but at a slower rate. Water from the river has forced officials to evacuate 29 homes in Lawrence County. Crests above flood stage are predicted for several Georgia rivers later this week. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 7 points at 3960. This is NPR. President Clinton says Republicans want to go too far in cutting back government regulations. Mr. Clinton has criticized GOP plans for a moratorium on new government rules. He says the plans are extreme and would cost lives and dollars. The House of Representatives will vote this week on the moratorium plan. There is a requirement that would make government look at costs before imposing new regulations. The president says that may sound good, but it doesn't work. He says it will block federal actions to protect the environment, consumers, and workers. A French court has barred the environmental group Greenpeace from interfering with a shipment of radioactive nuclear waste. The 14-ton load is being shipped from France to Japan. Some 20 countries have expressed concern. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The court ruled that members of Greenpeace cannot approach the vessel, which is currently docked at a port in northern France. It also barred the group from going near the ship while it's in French waters. French government has brought in military commandos who've surrounded the port. The nuclear waste has been moved from a French reprocessing plant to a depot near the ship, It's encased in glass and will be shipped in a heavy transport container designed for carrying radioactive materials. Greenpeace says if the ship has an accident, the container could burst and contaminate the environment. A number of countries have demanded to know the route the ship will take, but both France and Japan are refusing to reveal any details. Japanese officials say the ship will set sail on Thursday. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Environmental Protection Agency says it'll review complaints about a gasoline blend that it says helps clean the air. Some motorists say it's making them sick and their cars run poorly. The EPA is requiring the use of the reformulated fuel in some parts of the country to fight air pollution. Hundreds of people crammed a hall in Milwaukee yesterday to protest the requirement. Some say the fuel causes respiratory problems and headaches. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. May Berenbaum used to be terrified of insects. Now she studies them and teaches students about them. Of course, she's not above playing to her students' anxieties. This Saturday, she hosts her annual Insect Fear Film Festival at the University of Illinois, where she heads the entomology department. Aren't you glad you've never been pursued by giant, blood-sucking parasites like the poor characters in the film Ticks?
What is it?
Ixodes damini. Judging from the mandibles and the pseudo-head, a wood tick.
Ticks do not get this big.
It's a tick. Severely altered, but a tick all the same.
What happened to it?
The specimen has been covered with something. Possibly an herbal steroid.
Steroid?
It's illegal, but some of the farmers up here use it on their marijuana fields to accelerate growth. But that's between us, understand?
What if there are more of these out there?
What we do know is out there is plenty of insect films. We'll hear about May Berenbaum's Insect Fear Film Festival in a few minutes. First, let's hear a little bit about the real world of insects, which I think you'll agree is usually creepy enough. Berenbaum writes about insect life in her new book, Bugs in the System. She says that 80% of the world's species are insects, so it's not altogether surprising that insects can be found just about everywhere.
There are insects that live, for example, flies, small flies that live in petroleum pools, you know, so pools of crude oil. And they swim about happily waiting for fellow insects without the capacity to live in crude oil to fall in and get mired, and that's what they eat. There are insects that live in glaciers, which would seem to be anathema to a cold-blooded organism. There are insects that live inside the nostrils of sea lions, which hardly seems like an enviable sort of place to live. There are insects that, mosquitoes, for example, that breed in baptismal fonts. There are, in fact, mosquitoes that can breed in coal mines that are a mile below the surface. So there are insects just about everywhere you look.
You point out that insects owe their success to physiological and anatomical innovations that often give them the competitive edge over other animals. For example, they're really small in size. Well, how does that help insects adapt?
Well, being small allows an insect or any organism to partition up the environment more to a finer degree than a larger organism can. Insects that eat plants, for example, can concentrate their efforts on particular parts of individual species, whereas a large grazing mammal like a bison or a horse has to consume many different kinds of plants in a relatively large area. So that's how it comes to be that insects can live, for example, inside your box of grape nuts or Wheaties or whatever and find all the material needs met in just a simple box of cereal.
Why do insects have hard shells?
The external skeleton, the exoskeleton, serves the same basic function as our internal skeleton. It's kind of an anchor for our muscles so we can move our limbs around. But from the insect point of view, it's a lot more efficient. Being small, they have a relatively limited amount of material to work with. And it's a general rule of physics that for a given amount of material, a hollow rod supports greater weight than does a solid rod using the same amount of material. This is why, for example, lawn furniture, aluminum lawn furniture, is tubular. It's not made of solid bars of aluminum because it would bend. So with a limited amount of material, you get nice jointed appendages that can bear a lot of weight because it's a hard external skeleton. They serve as very good anchors for muscles, and they're very efficient in that way.
What are the drawbacks of carrying around this hard shell?
Well, No one has yet devised an external skeleton that grows with you. It's kind of like outgrowing your jeans and not being able to button the top button. When you get bigger, you have to get rid of that external skeleton and come up with a new one. So all organisms that have this hard external skeleton, all arthropods, have to, during the course of their life, shed that skeleton at regular or sometimes irregular intervals. And that's a relatively vulnerable point in the insect's life cycle, to shed the hard skin and just be without it for some length of time.
Which are the insects that do that?
That shed their skin?
Mm-hmm.
They're everybody. All insects, all arthropods, all... Well, when I use the term arthropod, I mean the phylum Arthropoda. This is the larger category to which the class Insecta belongs. All jointed-legged animals with external skeletons. So it includes not just insects, but spiders and horseshoe crabs and ticks and mites and scorpions and the like.
Spiders shed their shell?
Oh, yeah, regularly. In fact, unlike insects, they continue to shed their skin into their adulthood, into past sexual maturity.
So how come I've never seen spider shells kicking around?
Well, as I mentioned, when an insect molts, it's pretty vulnerable. Once the old skin is shed, it takes a while for the new skin to harden. And during that time, an insect is virtually defenseless, kind of like a knight in armor without his armor, standing in his underwear or something, very vulnerable to the elements.
So because an insect is very vulnerable when it sheds its exoskeleton, does it do it in hiding someplace out of our sight?
Yeah, generally any kind of arthropod in the process of molting is going to do it in some sort of concealed place where it's less exposed to the dangers that arthropods face on a daily basis.
Why can insects walk up walls or crawl across ceilings defying the laws of gravity?
Rather than defying the laws of gravity, what they're doing are obeying other physical laws. When organisms are very small, their life tends to be dominated not by forces that act on mass or volume, as we are, but rather that by forces that act on surface area. When you get to be very small, the relative ratio of surface area to volume, the sort of covering versus the weight, approaches unity. So insects have, per unit volume, more surface area than we do. And there are a lot of physical forces that are determined by surface area rather than by volume. And one of them is, well, gravity works on mass or volume. So we try to scale a wall, we're immediately brought down back down to the ground by gravity. When an insect tries to scale a wall, the forces of adhesion, which is a surface-related phenomenon, are greater than the forces of gravity. So flies have these little suction cups, and that's all they need on their feet, all they need to just scale a wall and walk upside down on the ceiling. There aren't suction cups really strong enough to for us to counteract the effects of gravity.
Do centipedes and ants have those little suction cups on their feet too?
There are tarsal claws, but whether they don't have the same general sort of structure. But even without, you know, dust clings to walls without suction cups. So you don't even need suction cups per se. That gives you an extra firm footing. But the forces of friction and adhesion will allow an insect to cling to a surface more efficiently if it's smaller than if it's bigger.
My guest is May Barenboim. She's written a new book called The Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about bugs. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about insects, and my guest, May Barenboim, is the author of the new book, The Bugs in the System. I want you to help me to understand something, and that's dust mites. You know, I always figured, well, you know, dust, who needs it? It's hard to clean. It's annoying. It makes you sneeze. But I never thought of little insects living in the dust, and I not too long ago became aware, through books, of dust mites. I mean, through reading about them in books. And I still don't really understand whether dust mites are microorganisms or whether they're actually little insects.
They're actually neither. They're mites, which are not insects. They're members of the class Arachnida, so their closest relatives that are sort of high profile would be spiders.
Well, that's not reassuring.
And the dust, that's really illustrates the point of how easily you can make a living if you're small. What dust mites do, that's, Dermatophagoides teranosinus is the name of the species. They live on, among other things, skin flakes shed by larger vertebrate organisms, particularly skin flakes that are overgrown by molds and fungi. So you can make a living eating somebody's dandruff.
Well, some of us would like to believe that what we can't see can't hurt us. Do dust mites cause problems?
Well, they are potentially harmful for anyone with allergies. Generally, if you've been diagnosed with an allergy to dust, what you really have is an allergy in many cases to dust mites, dust mite body parts, and dust mite excrement. So if you are afflicted with asthma or any other condition that's exacerbated by dust, then potentially dust mite infestation can prove very difficult or dangerous.
Now, do you get a creepy feeling thinking of little bugs inhabiting the dust?
Well, if you want to get creepy feelings, dust mites are not your biggest concern. There's also the face mite, which is even creepier. Yeah.
Okay, what's that?
This is a Demodex folliculorum. This is a little mite that lives on people's faces in the follicles, in the at the base of the hairs on the face, particularly around the eyebrows. And again, a very high proportion of the human population harbors populations of face mites on their faces.
Can you see them?
Well, most of the time they're concealed inside the hair follicle, so they're not sort of running around out on your face. But under some circumstances, if you pull out eyebrow hairs and look under the microscope, yeah, you can see them clinging to the end.
Now, do most of us have these mites, and how would we know if we do?
The vast majority of the population does have a few face mites. As to how you know they're there, you don't really. In most cases, they're completely innocuous and they don't cause any real complications. In some cases, they can cause problems of inflammation of the skin and the like, but these are the rare exceptions. They are just happy little commensals sharing our sebaceous secretions with us.
Oh, yeah. Well, they might be happy, but I'm not happy to hear about it. Was there a time when you were first learning about dust mites and face mites that you started to
itch? Yes.
Yes, first to itch and to feel bad wherever you looked.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Given how creepy insects can be, why do you study them?
Well, they're fascinating. They're amazing. And that's really only half the story. Insects contribute to human good, I think, in a greater magnitude than any other class of organisms on the planet, really.
Now, I know one of the things that you do at the University of Illinois is you show an insect film festival.
An insect fear film festival.
An insect fear film festival.
Yeah.
So you show movies where insects take over the world?
Basically, yeah.
Which movies?
Oh, geez, well, we're in our 12th year, so we've shown a lot of them. We often organize the festival around themes. So we had an all-cockroach festival one year, and this year we're doing parasites.
What are you showing this year?
We're hoping to show Brain Eaters, which is a 1958 film about Carboniferous-era maggots that latch onto the back of your neck and take over your personality. One called Skeeters and one called Ticks. These are films from the early 90s, plus a number of animated films, short cartoons about parasites, fleas, and mosquitoes and the like, of which there are many.
And what's your educational reason for showing the Insect Fear Film Festival?
Well, a long time ago, I figured that more people would pack into an auditorium to see Mothra or Beginning of the End than would come in to hear a lecture on insect physiology. So what we do is show the movies, and while they're sitting there, before the movie begins, give short introductory remarks on why what they're about to see can't possibly happen and the reasons for it. We also use the festival as an opportunity to show people the real insects behind the media hype, the Hollywood hype. So it's a rare opportunity for people to meet the stars.
Do you have a favorite? Do you have a current favorite bug film?
Oh, I have an all-time favorite bug film.
What is it?
Beginning of the End. This is a 1957 Burt I. Gordon film about giant grasshoppers induced by radiation experiments in a USDA lab in Rantoul, Illinois, that move through central Illinois, converge on Chicago, and end up drowning in Lake Michigan after scaling the Wrigley Building.
And what do you tell your students about why this could never happen?
Well, you can't have giant insects. Giant grasshoppers would be a physiological impossibility for several reasons. First of all, when they get that big, if they had to shed their skin or molt, gravity would basically flatten them before sclerotization, before this skin hardening can take place. Secondly, because of the nature, the structure of insect appendages, you have joints that are weight-bearing, very small joints that are weight-bearing, kind of like how high heels tend to concentrate weight. Well, you'd have to have joints made of diamonds. I mean, cuticle's hard, but it's not hard enough to bear all that weight. And finally, insects breathe in a different way from the way we breathe. They have a system of interconnecting tubes that get smaller and smaller branches throughout the entire body and delivers oxygen directly to every cell through tinier and tinier tubes. Well, that works if you're small, but if you get big and you don't have a system to move the air through that system of tubes, then you just insects would not get enough oxygen to provide their energy needs, and they, if they were indeed that big, they'd be sort of lying flat on the ground panting.
Well,
if an insect could pant.
I feel good knowing that grasshoppers aren't going to take over the world. That's good news. May Barenbaum, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks.
May Barenbaum is the author of Bugs in the System. She chairs the entomology department at the University of Illinois, where she hosts her Insect Fear Film Festival this weekend.
Hang on.
Charles! Charles! Charles!
When in doubt, squish.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the United States' effort to support the Mexican peso, what's entailed in it, and what the Mexicans have to say about it. Also on today's program, we'll hear about Aldrich Ames, the convicted spy who was arrested a year ago. Martha Raddatz reports on Ames and the Central Intelligence Agency. And we'll be hearing about a county in West Virginia which hasn't been able to get its bills reimbursed by the Pentagon, so it has told the Pentagon to keep its airplanes out of its airspace.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the first time, the poems of Langston Hughes have been collected in a single volume. The Collected Poems of Langston Hughes is edited by Hughes' biographer, Arnold Rampersad. Critic Gerald Early has a review.
So will my page be colored that I write? Being me, it will not be white. But it will be a part of you, instructor. You are white. Yet a part of me is I am a part of you. That's American. These are lines from Langston Hughes' popular poem, Theme for English B, published in the spring of 1949. Although Hughes wrote it in his middle 40s, it has the characteristics of much of the work he produced as the young Turk poet of the Harlem Renaissance. The rhythmic rhyming, the very accessible language, hip but unaffected, and most important, the sense of America as an amalgam, a very mixed and mixed-up sense of pluralism. Critics are right who suggest that Hughes was our greatest poet of democracy, our greatest chanter of the poetics of pluralism since Walt Whitman. The recently issued collected poems of Langston Hughes, edited by Hughes's biographer Arnold Rampersad, poses the question just how great a poet was Langston Hughes. We face two problems in considering Hughes the poet. First, Hughes wrote a great deal of significant work in other genres. autobiography, fiction, plays, children's books, newspaper pieces, histories, and anthologies. Pressed to support himself solely through writing, Hughes wrote constantly. This work deflects our attention from the poetry, and in some sense it may have deflected his attention from poetry as well. I think Hughes clearly loved writing and reading poetry more than anything else, and often wrote another genre simply for the money. The sheer volume of Hughes's work gives the impression that here was a somewhat harried man who, as James Baldwin once suggested, squandered his considerable gifts instead of employing them to his best benefit. Second, all of us who encountered Hughes's work when we were children tend to relegate it to our childhood. Hughes's poetry is used mostly to introduce children to poetry, not to sustain people's interest in it when they become adults. But as I delved into great chunks of Hughes's poetic work, I remembered the line from Whitman, "I am the man, I suffered, I was there." There are a number of bad poems here, but riches abound here. Hughes's experiments with vernacular, blues, and spirituals that revolutionized American poetry, his grand inclusivity and epic sense of black life, his amazing ability to combine heartbreak and humor. Unlike Count Cullen, the other great poet to emerge from the Harlem Renaissance, Hughes's muse never deserted him. Unlike Zora Neale Hurston, the other great Renaissance writer who loved black folk culture, Hughes survived his worst mistakes. His poems are the story of one man's will to love his people and to love being American. And he found the perfect expression of democratic pluralism in black American music. "I wouldn't give up jazz for a world revolution," he wrote. Overworked, haunted by his sexual ambiguity, angered by racism, unsure of his talent, harassed by anti-communists, Hughes never lost faith in the renewing possibilities of this teeming world and his ability to absorb them. "I play it cool and dig all jive. That's the reason I stay alive. My motto as I live and learn is dig and be dug in return."
Gerald Early teaches English literature at Washington University in St. Louis. His book, The Culture of Bruising, has been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn are our interns. I'm Cherry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.